Welcome to the Anarchist News Podcast. This week, we are going to mix it up a little bit. This week, the B team is going to present the news and have a conversation about the topic of the week. This iteration of the A-News Podcast is going to be more conversational than it's going to be authoritative. Hopefully next week, Chisel will be back and we will be relieved from the stress of having to think about anything at all. Introducing the A-News Podcast this week, and this is the members of the B team, include me. My name is Neo. We're also going to have Ingrate, and finally, Max Power.
Hello.
So we begin. This is the April 12th edition of the Anarchist News Podcast.
Know your enemy. A green anarchist response to the Christchurch shooter's manifesto. A significant part of my desire to write this response came out of the hope that it might reach other young men who are compelled by the narratives of environmental defense and strong community that Tarrant has claimed to embrace and clarify the deep, ugly, and hateful truths of his position. I also hope to present an alternative, and I believe significantly more honest, view of the problems facing the world and its communities than the horrible, warped explanations he offers. Yeah.
Yeah, this was mostly reposted in some like Medium kind of format, right? Or no, it was Gods and Radicals.
It was Gods and Radicals.
And this was just the first part, but there were actually, in fact, three parts, and they sort of seemed to extend their stories to get further clicks or some strange thing. So
yeah, I actually posted the whole thing.
Oh, okay. So what did you think
of
the story in general of this person's story?
So I thought that for someone who goes on to say that they're a post-left anti-civ anarchist, the author dwells a lot on the way the white working class is being exploited. In fact, like just to quote, like, this has been better discussed elsewhere, but I will briefly say that that we must always be cautious in our theorizing and propagandizing on incendiary issues like immigration, to never leave ambiguous and potentially race-related doors open, as others have been quick to take advantage of our failures in this area. Successes by the right wing in recruiting among the white working class are, I believe, largely owed to simple but deliberate and calculated misrepresentations, like those by Tarrant, I don't know how you pronounce that asshole's name, own manifesto. Once workers are divided by race, with white workers feeling victimized by immigrant job thieves and welfare parasites, and it goes on. And I didn't disagree with the piece overall, but it left me feeling like it kept coming back to sort of an essentialist sort of a politics of like class or race politics. And by the end, they wrap it up a little bit better, but I don't know, like the whole thing of like, this has been better discussed elsewhere. I'm like where?
Like, yeah, that would be it, nice. Yeah.
The first time that I looked at this article, I actually stopped reading right there because it started sounding too much like some Reed Ross stuff with like a little GA twist to it.
Right. Did you have other?
Right. I think it's kind of interesting that the context in which this is emerging is this. I mean, it's PR in part, right? They're making an active effort to say, we green anarchists are not like eco-fascists who are cropping up now claiming that they love the earth.
Yeah.
I think that I mean, that's kind of an interesting impulse that people feel the need to respond to that. And also, I mean, they mentioned like Jordan Peterson in here. Like, they're definitely, I mean, the intent of the article is absolutely like, I mean, the author even says this, like, I wish someone had said this to me when I was thinking about fasci ideas as a green anarchist before I learned better.
I guess part of my thing is I don't feel like I ever thought about fasci ideas as a budding little green twig or whatever.
But I mean, obviously what this is about is the fact that, that if you're going to speak in a modern public voice about green ideas, you have to apologize for essentially eco-fascism. And the question is that the right approach? Is the right approach to do that apologizing or to say, fuck you in the context that you wrote in on?
Right. And I think my perspective is influenced by my age, which eco-fascism, the first time I encountered that term was the Janet Beale, whoever else book about eco-fascism. It was very much a bookgenist.
You mean the Earth attack first, on, the Earth First stuff in the 80s or the, or?
No. So Murray Bookchin's longtime partner.
No, I know.
Wrote a small book that was, I mean, it was directed towards Earth First / anarcho-primitivism. And I don't remember the complete title, but it's available on theanarchistlibrary.org.
So it was a longish essay she wrote in the last 10 years?
Not in the last 10 years. This is late 90s, early 2000s.
Okay. Thank you.
And it it was very clearly a polemic attacking green anarchist, I would say. I mean, and Earth First, which I don't think we can lump in with green anarchists exactly.
Yep.
But, okay. You know, very much attacking any non-Bookchinist eco-anarchy thing.
The next...
And so for... Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Finish your thought.
Oh, no. So for me, I read any sort of defense against eco-fascism through that lens. And at the same time, I think that there has been an evolution in white supremacist or white nationalist or whatever you want to call them, like their politics, where there is something that like we need to look at. I just don't know that this essay or analysis does it exactly.
So I guess I think we're in for a penny in for a pound because we've now done almost 9 minutes on this story and we actually haven't, we haven't really talked about it. So let's actually talk about it because I don't think that eco-fascism and green anarchism, for instance, should be in dialogue with each other. Like, in other words, I don't think that green anarchists should devote a lot of energy to responding to sort of the assertion that if you're a green anarchist, you're an eco-fascist. And I think that that kind of slippery thinking or sloppy thinking sort of speaks to a big problem that's happening today. And this is no indictment on the article itself. You know, I think that it's fine if you're writing for Gods and Radicals and on some level you're doing 101 kind of work where you're introducing people to what green anarchist ideas are and in the context of this shooting. Okay, all that's fine. But you know, I think that for us, let's say as green anarchists, I'm not sure, like if there's an idea that an eco-fascist has, I think we should talk about it, begin it, you know, with framing it by who came up with the idea and then end it and then move on. In other words, I think that there's a fundamental issue that we have where we take critics too seriously, especially if they get more ink than we do. And that's really what this feels like.
I would agree. And that's part of when I said that this felt a little bit like it was tilting towards the Reed Ross sort of a perspective, like it's sort of that feeling that it's already engaging too much, like, and trying to draw links where there's not, which doesn't mean that we shouldn't be aware, but doesn't mean that we need to try and defend ourselves from being connected to it somehow when we're not.
Okay. Let's just move on. The next story from this week is from CrimeThink, and it's called Against the Logic of the Guillotine. And the nice thing about this article is that it's basically criticizing the way in which the popular imagine has revitalized the guillotine as a solution to or a device to use in class struggle. And it sort of makes a simple case using a lot of historical examples that the guillotine is an example of how authoritarian violence happens, not an example of libertarian violence, because, of course, it's more difficult than one might imagine to come up with examples of libertarian violence. If anyone has any thoughts, now is the time to jump in.
Yeah. I have mixed feelings about this. I mean, I liked it as a critique of resentment. Like, I thought it was good. You know, I mean, I could say the same thing about, I guess you could write the same article about the use of the hammer and sickle by a lot of anarchists now, but it's, I liked it as like, well, you guys are using this symbol, but like, A, there's no way you can possibly do this right now. And also B, do you actually understand the implications of this kind of violence?
Yeah. I
know no anarchists personally who are super stoked on the idea of guillotines other than in like sort of a joking rhetorical way. This article has a lot of pretty pictures, including one from my city. And I've never seen that poster before. Like, it's, you know, it, anyway, like it, I think that I agree with Max Power about this, basically.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on. Brexit.
Brexit. Okay. Brexit. Slow internet. Brexit chaos. We need a bit more anarchy. The beginning of this felt like a song from Yes, Sir, I Will by Crass. Like, the spectacle of Brexit debacle will be comic if it weren't for the fact that the consequences of the antics of the politicians will be largely felt by the working class. I mean, it feels very much like the analysis that you would expect from the anarchist communist group from England. That's what I've got to say about it.
So
mostly
you're saying,
I just wanted to do a Crass impersonation.
So you're saying they're totally coherent.
You know, what I'm saying is that put to their own devices, they probably couldn't organize a piss up in a brewery.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, I guess I've always been a little curious about, I mean, I don't know a lot of British anarchists, but the sense that I get of them over the internet is that they really like to talk about politics, which kind of confuses me.
Yeah, it's very different than the US in that way. And they also are all pretty much class struggle. Like, they mean they're all class struggle weaved into their DNA in a way that is is strange to us in the US.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I mean, I think that that's real in some ways, that it's, or maybe not real, but like it's very different, like the understanding of class in the UK than it is in the United States context.
Yes. The fact that Jeff Bezos dresses like us, I think sort of says it all.
He doesn't dress like me.
He dresses like us.
I look way better.
He might not wear cut down Dickies and a sloppy punk shirt, but he does wear, you know, clean Dockers and a button down shirt.
Sure. And maybe more of an Elon Musk look than like casual.
Yeah.
All right. Are we moving on?
Countdown to steal something from Workday 2019. This is another CrimeThink project. In anticipation of April 15th, the 10th annual Steal Something from Workday, we have prepared a brand new website collecting 9 years of Steal Something from Work testimonials, interviews, educational materials, and analysis. A treasure trove of first-person perspectives about stealing from work. God. This is a definitive resource for employee-led wealth distribution. No, redistribution. Well, I'm
and or distribution.
Yeah, I guess color me excited.
It's already been a year.
Yeah.
I mean, was the last time that anyone stole something from work a year ago last Monday? Because, like, you're doing it wrong.
I think that's a provocative direction to take this in.
I think the site is clearly aimed at normal people who see the sticker or what have you, and then they go to the site and it's like, here's an FAQ about why it's okay to steal from work.
So you're saying it's geared towards the Protestant audience?
It is. It is.
It's, yeah, this is a very, this feels like when I worked for nonprofits and we did outreach in some way, like it's proselytizing.
But I think as you just brought up, it's obviously proselytizing to an audience who perhaps is already stealing from work. I mean, although whatever, I scanned the FAQ and they do say like, yes, people steal from work all the time, but this is more aimed at people who are like, oh, I don't know if I should steal from work. Here's a long list of reasons why it's okay.
Mm-hmm. Moving on.
But do you think, yeah, moving on. We don't need to talk about that.
Who is doing
that? Hey, that is me. That is me. So the next article is
Max Power.
A report back. Commercial Hub slowed down for a week following incendiary sabotage. This was an article from Act for Freedom Now, which they translated. This took place in France. This was a straightforward report back with details about damaging telecommunications infrastructure for a commercial center and the aftermath. I appreciated this in a way. It's nice to see some variety in report backs. This was, I mean, they generally, I think, fall into one or two, one being a lot of bombastic language with like we damaged the telephone pole, and this one being a very straightforward, here's how we did it, and then here's the destruction that we caused without a lot of rhetoric. And
Anarchy Radio, 4/9/2019. Filling the Void, Bruce Alexander on Addiction as a Response to the Void of the Culture. More Cities Submerging, Synthetic Biology on the March versus Health Failures All Over the World. Reality Too Depressing. Instagram, Snapchat, Ruining Memories. Google Smart Compose. Bots take over writing thinking. Cognitive tech lined up to read our thoughts. Barry Lopez's Horizon. No resistance, no alternative paradigm. Resistance briefs, one call.
Well, I think it's obvious that it's all coming to collapse.
Yeah.
I mean, the signs are everywhere.
It's true. Everywhere on the New York Times. from identity to individuality. I think that's me. I think I'm the one who
committed go for it.
To that one. This is actually a sort of funny sort of confessional letter written in that's kind of trying to critique what would we say it's trying to critique? It's sort of critiquing left. It's sort of a coming of age story from someone who's declaring themselves to be post-left. The author is calling, it's called the subtitle From Identity to Individuality, A Nihilist Personal History and Leftism by Baba Yaga.
Baba Yaga.
Yeah.
I think there you go.
Yeah. Not much to say about it other than, you know, it's sort of funny. It's sort of someone committed to it, which I like. A lot of times these things are only like 100 or 200 words long. Just to read the end of it. When I begin shedding these behaviors, this is obviously a Stirner-esque, you know, coming to be, I became more open and comfortable with the people around me, which of course is how people who are open and comfortable talk. Rather than adhering to these strict rules, we felt free to communicate our individual desires. I could tell my friends that they could touch me.
Our collective individual. Okay. Yeah. Sorry, go on.
We're all individuals here. I could tell my friends that they could touch me freely without feeling obligated to ask me each time. I could assure them that if I didn't want to be touched at a particular time or in a particular way, I would communicate that to them. My POC friends could tell me what words and actions they were personally comfortable with, rather than feeling compelled to uphold some sort of community rules or morals. My friends of all different socially constructed identities, by race, gender, sex, etc., could behave as they wished, without being concerned that they were fulfilling stereotypes or betraying their identities. It's far from utopian, but as leftism continues to demonstrate, utopia is impossible without authoritarianism.
Boom.
Chilling.
That was like a hard stop.
Well, that's why I changed my inflection to make it more powerful.
I would like to ask my POC friends what words and actions they're personally comfortable with.
I don't know
if anybody here has input on that, but
I don't want to be too cruel to this because like they tried and this is as good of an effort as I would anticipate from, you know, a young writer who's doing the thing and they're trying to, you know, I mean, this is actually one of the things I don't like about individualist writing is that a lot of individualist writing tends to come off in this way. Like, and I'm referring to like, you know, like, obviously, I'm good friends with the people who do Enemy Combatant, but a lot of the essays that they publish like have this kind of a feel to it. Like, now that I am totally free and the ghosts have been chased away, I'm free.
You have no more spooks.
Exactly. A spook for your life.
It's to be honest, like snark aside, and I feel like there's a way in which, at least with some of the people involved in the B team, like the snark tends to accelerate a little bit.
It is our strong suit.
Yeah. I appreciate this because it does actually reflect, I can't say that my upbringing was the same or that my perspectives as a child were the same as the author's, but that idea of like I was involved in the left anarchy thing, via Food Not Bombs, via, you know, anti-globalization things and activism and whatnot, and kept butting up against like post-left GA sort of thinking. And that resonated with me, but I was like, but no, like all the people that I learned from are like, that's stupid. And so like, there's a piece of this that like really does speak to me as far as like resonating with my coming of age thing, but it is very much like a kind of coming of age thing.
Let's move on. Who is doing Puerto Rico?
Okay. I think that I got, or did you get delegated that?
I'll do it.
Okay.
Let's see. Okay. Anarchism and Socialism in Puerto Rico from Below podcast. This was a 45-minute roughly piece discussing the history of earliest 20th century anarchy and socialism in Puerto Rico. It's an interview and discussion with historian Jorel Melendez Badillo on the history of anarchism and socialism in Puerto Rico. I listened to some of this, and it's very straightforward. What I told you is basically just what it is. I don't have any big thoughts about it, but it was interesting hearing the politics of what was going on in Puerto Rico in radical politics, especially debates around whether people should become part of the U.S. or not. But it did seem a little heavy on talking about socialism for something that was also about anarchy.
That's how they rope us in.
That's how they get you.
Yeah. Okay, next story.
I believe that's me again. Italy. David Delagu transferred from Augusta to Rossano Calabro prison. This is from anarchia.info. There is a prisoner. His name is David Delagu, and he has been transferred, and this has his new address. This didn't come with any context for who this person is, so I did some research, and apparently this guy has been in prison since 2010 He was sentenced to an 8-year prison sentence for theft and attempted murder, though it's not clear what led to that. I haven't found any like more substantial things than that. He's tried to break out of prison at least once and appears engaged in a prison struggle. So I don't know how that's affected his sentence either, but he has received some special targeting apparently from the guards.
Topic of the week, anarchists in the academy. The further I get away from college, the stranger the academy appears to me. My education as an anarchist came after I graduated, and as a result, I was spared some of the serious anarchist academics seriousness anarchist academics seem to ascribe to pluralizing nouns like anarchy, praxis, or whiteness, lest any readers assume that there was just one kind. When I look at anarchists in the academy, they mostly appear as strangers to me, an incestuous community of people who are employed, however precariously as many appear to be adjuncts, at educational institutions and whose anarchies, appear to consist of volumes analyzing social movements and keeping each other employed through long lists of citations of these volumes. People, with some notable exceptions, who rarely appear in the wild. That's a funny sentence. And they do pop up often, appear lost and bewildered, sitting behind a table with a handful of inscrutable tomes in front of them as their eyes search the room for a kindred spirit to share the joys of their latest research project and the woes of non-tenure-track positions. At the same time, I can enjoy theory and look with more than a little suspicion at people who say they're beyond it, or try to bludgeon you with the mantra of action above all else. Certainly not all anarchists in the academy have fallen into the abyss I've described, right? Theoretically, the academy can provide us knowledge not otherwise obtainable outside of it, as well as the time and space to develop our thoughts while getting paid to do so. What are your thoughts on the academy and how we relate to it as anarchists? Max Power, Ingrate, respond.
Well, I actually wrote this, so I'm very Yeah, I know the math.
behind the veil.
Beyond the veil, yes. And I wrote it in part because the distro that I'm a part of got invited to a conference that's actually happening right now in about anarchy, but it's at Wesleyan and it's being held by a professor, and that's their lineup. It's basically a series of talks by anarchists in the academy. I don't know. This was provocative, also somewhat conciliatory towards the end, but I do feel like I'm not sure what to make of this thing anymore.
Have you gone to many of these events?
No, not at all.
Because they are mostly terrible. Like,
tell me more.
Well, the presentation style at sort of like anarcho-academic type events tends to be the work that these people are already doing, which, you know, almost anyone who's in the academy, and this is usually grad students, and are trying to grapple with the questions of like, how can I do something that I actually care about at the same time that I secure my future, or at least, you know, participate in my own future. You know, they have a lot of thinking to do to reconcile all of this. But that said, they also do the same presentations for the anarchist event as they do for their sociology conference or their history conference or whatever their particular discipline is. So they get up. I mean, you know, mostly it's like in a university context. And if there are tablers, they're like in a maybe vaguely central location, and they're usually seen between conference proposals, topics, conversations. But basically, you know, there's a lectern. Someone gets up on the lectern. They pull out their paper, 10 pages, and they just read it. And, you know, when you listen to it, like, they might do a 10% good job at like changing the words out so it sounds more anarchist than sociologist. But, you know, they're reading their 10-page, 20-page paper on very much their specialist topic. And, you know, most of the people they're speaking to are the professors that are in the room, although they're obviously under the social obligation to try to appeal to you too. You know, it's just normally terrible. Terrible from the perspective of like getting new ideas and actually doing the thing that they want to do, which is sort of like dreamily approach the thing that is interesting to them. So you see all these tensions come together. Most of the tensions come together in a very boring way. It's very hard to do a good paper that, you know, in the best of situations, and usually these are not in the best of situations. Usually these events are overfilled with locals rather than sort of like interesting people necessarily. So that's sort of like a nutshell, but that's been my experience. And I've probably been to 10 to 20, probably closer to 20 of them.
Wow.
I think, go ahead, Max.
Yeah, no, please.
I mean, this is a hard topic.
We're so polite.
Yeah. Go ahead.
It is a hard topic, and I think I don't necessarily have anything against anarchists that are in the academy any more than I have something against anarchists that are working for nonprofits or teaching or whatever. Like you need a job. I mean, Crime Think might tell us we don't, but realistically, most folks, and no, I don't think so. But you know, I'm of a certain age, so,
sure.
I feel like there's a way in which like, I'm not anti that. And I have many friends who are anarchists who have pursued academic careers. The folks that I'm closest to, like those careers haven't worked out and they're doing a different thing. They've just got PhD after their name now. which is sometimes to their benefit, sometimes not. As far as like trying to come back around to what I was initially wanting to talk about, like I feel like speaking to what Neo was saying about how rote the presentations are and how it contrasts with maybe what they actually want, that there's a way in which academic rigor, as far as like having to have citations, having to be able to document everything and where it comes from, stifles the, I don't know, the creative nothing.
Sure. I mean, but that's, of course, that's kind of obvious too, right?
You know, that's my job, stating the obvious.
But I mean, in other words, the problem is like, how, you know, I think like you, I don't actually have a particular problem with someone who decides to go into the academy, but I guess I do have a little bit of a problem with like them being the ones who get to control thought within the anarchist space, as an example.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think all of us can think about people who ended up succeeding in some, you know, meager way in the academy, who then become the like spokespeople for a particular kind of position just because they went to the academy to learn and talk about it. That I don't love that. And you know, I don't particularly think Deleuze is important as an example to the anarchist project. But
Guattari though?
You forgot about Guattari.
I think that they're fine. They're fine things to study and all the rest. But then but now I'm ready to move on. And they're not, because that's really what they have. And so to me, that's more the question from like, you know, if there is a question about the anarchist academy, it's sort of like, to what extent do we want specialization in this way to be a big part of our project? And I think that, you know, the answer is as little as possible, but I get it. Like I get that, you know, I get it. For me, this question is I guess much more like, how do we do better at providing a space to talk about these sort of things without the academy? Because, you know, we're never really going to succeed there. A couple people might have some limited success, but I think that we, as people who like ideas and people who want to do ideas, I mean, whatever. Obviously, my bias is that I am a publisher that does not have any relationship or funding by the academy, and I'm not looking to get that funding. I'm instead looking to see what anarchists can come up with on our own.
I mean, I think, personally, I think that there's a lot of ways. One of the things, I would be interested to hear what a friend, a mutual friend of some of ours, Sean Wilbur, thinks about this as someone who is not in the academy but does that deep research.
Yes, that's true.
And I know that... yeah, like I mean, I think that he's doing work that's not always interesting to me personally, but that I appreciate is being done. I don't know. That's one thought on that.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me,
go ahead.
It's always great to give.
I think for me,
go ahead.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I will take the go ahead. I think for me, part of what I appreciate, and I mentioned this in the topic of the week, is that at the very least, what you get theoretically in the academy is time to knead your ideas and write in a way that's like, this is what is expected of you, regardless of what actually comes out of that. And I know for myself, like, I am... whatever, I am part of the gig economy. I actually have a lot of free time. And I've been able to use that in a way that I imagine people working twice as much as me, which would be full time, just it's much more difficult for them to have the same kind of time to just spend with ideas or you know, finding new information.
Yeah, I feel pretty strongly that that this is more a matter of perception than of reality, meaning that most grad students that I've experienced always are very stressed out because of the volume of reading that they're required to do, and because they tend to have some sort of careerist expectations about what it is that they're doing. And so don't actually spend that time like doing, you know, a time intensive speculative research, but instead do time intensive required reading, and then participate in some degree of playing games so that they can actually have a career after their 8 years of, you know, graduate education. Whereas people like you who basically live on very limited means and have essentially chosen time instead of career, tend to have a lot more free time to do the sort of things that we're implying when we talk about the academy.
Sure. That makes sense to me. I'm interested, actually. You mentioned this earlier, but the fact that you mentioned this with Deleuze, like a lot of people have big ideas, and that's very much true, I think, of a lot of academics I've seen. And I think that being in the academy incentivizes that literally through money and giving you a career about it, but you have to have that big idea and you have to sell that big idea. And that kind of environment doesn't really lend itself to innovation.
Yeah. Other thoughts, Ingrid?
Yeah. No, I honestly, not really. I think I never went to college other than like some community college. So my connection to like the academy is through people I know. What I know is that a lot of folks who were anarchists who went on to pursue their post-grad degrees became Marxists, more or less, if they weren't already, except calling themselves anarchists. And at the same time, I know some folks who are anarchists and are in the academy and, like I said, like do their thing and make their money. And okay.
Well, thank you very much. This was the B team. That being Neo, Ingrate, and Max Power, we just accomplished discussion of this week's anarchist news. Basically, the stories that came up this week with the week off that was last week. Thank you very much to both Ingrate and Max Power for their participation. Other people that help out with this podcast include Lynn O'Mabel, Dim Chisel, and yeah. So, thank you very much, people.
How much of a shit show was this?
It was a shit show.
Yes.
That's all, folks.